Okay, good afternoon. All right, well, back into doctrines. This is a handout for your information. Article on the Sabbath out of the Anchor Bible Dictionary. I thought it would be a good one for you to have for your records, for your notebook. It's the article on the Sabbath. The Anchor Bible Dictionary is a more liberal dictionary. I think we have the full volumes in our ABC library. It's not your conservative type of commentary, all right? So it's a very liberal approach. But their article on the Sabbath is, I think, an exceptional one. And given that the source, a liberal commentary on the Bible, their article on the Sabbath is very good. It's pretty well straight down the line, and I thought it would be good for your records. Somehow I inherited it from someone, don't know who. And they'd already marked it up, then I've made my own markings in it, so you make your own markings in it. But you'll see certain highlights, and I apologize for that, but at least you'll see what is emphasized. And it's a very good article. Just read it for your information, for your records to have for that. We basically have covered the essentials of the syllabus. I had said Monday that we would talk a little bit about how the Sabbath was changed, and I'd bring some material that I had covered years ago. Then Mr. Petty has his module now on early church history, and we probably overlap a little bit, but he may emphasize things that I don't. So I thought, since I brought it up the other day, we'll go ahead and take a few minutes to kind of talk about a little bit of that period in the changeover from a historical period. What I would do is basically show how the faith once delivered. In the book of Jude is the statement, I think it's Jude 6. That we are to contend for the faith once delivered. And my thesis of my presentation was to try to show from history how the truth got changed. All right, this is something I kind of got into 22 years ago after the worldwide debacle and how they changed the truth. And from my own personal knowledge, I wanted to find out, you know, what I could. And I took a study of church history from a point of view of just looking at the doctrine, all right, not trying to trace the church, but to trace the doctrine. And Jude 6 was my anchor verse, that we are to contend for the faith once delivered, that i.e. Christ put true doctrine into his church. The apostles taught true doctrine. They kept the Sabbath, they kept the holy days, they believed in the millennium, they believed in his return, they kept the Passover, holy days, et cetera, right on down the line. How did that get changed was my real burning question. How did that get changed from the time of the end of the first century, or what we would call the apostolic period, with the death of the Apostle John that ended all the 12 apostles? And I already knew from growing up in the church and hearing church history some of the story, but to be honest, a lot of it was never really put together, and I had to put it together myself. And so I would present material about showing how the millennium, the teaching about the millennium was changed, the holy days and the Sabbath. So what we'll cover tonight is essentially a little bit of understanding about how it got changed on the Sabbath. We've gone through the scriptures on the Sabbath. We've covered kind of the basic syllabus on it. You can go deeper and deeper and deeper into it. I do want to come back to my syllabus material and we'll conclude that, but this is a different presentation. What I called this was early church history, the age of shadows and beyond. And we're talking about anti-Jewish feeling and certain personalities and the Sabbaths, i.e. the Sabbath and the holy days. Okay? It's Jude 3, my mistake, that the quote is. Beloved, while I was diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation, I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith which was once for all delivered to the saints. In a sense, we continue to have to contend for the faith once delivered. I think each generation has to go through proving, reproving at times, bolstering, defending. You're going through apologetics. Mr. Myers is taking you through that, where you defend, learn to defend the faith. Every generation has to do that. This was written to the first generation, but it was written during a time when the faith was being dismantled within the church. This is a picture of that man I told you about at the beginning of the story of Acts, Mr. Edward Gibbon. In that famous 15th chapter of his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. As he writes about this particular period, the period we're talking about is largely the very end of the first century, with the time of around the 90s AD after the death of John. And for the next 20, 30, 40 years, he says there are scanty and suspicious materials of ecclesiastical history that seldom enable us to dispel the dark cloud that hangs over the first age of the church. His contention, and I think I have another quote here from another individual out of the story of the Christian church, is that once the book of Acts and the New Testament ends, and the revealed history and story of the church, as Mr. Hurlbut says here, that last generation of the first century called the Age of Shadows, from, he says, 68 to 100, because of the gloom of persecution over the church, and more especially because of all the periods of history, it's the one about which we know the least. For 50 years after Paul's life, a curtain hangs over the church through which we strive to look. And when at last it rises, about 120 AD, with the writings of the earliest church fathers, we find a church in many aspects very different from that in the days of Peter and Paul, and we could say the other apostles. Well, that's a good quote. Now, I've had that in all of our church publications about the subject back in the day. Jesse Hurlbut, The Story of the Christian Church. But it's like a curtain went down on this stage, and then about 120 AD, the curtain rises, but we see a different church than the one we read about in the book of Acts and the epistles. Now, that's a generalization. In some ways, I would take issue with this. This was written 60, 70, 80 years ago. I'm not quite sure when Mr. Hurlbut wrote his book. I would take exception with it today. I would say that we can know more than we think we know. It is a different church, but we can trace a lot from not only biblical markers, but also extra-biblical histories that we have access to, and we can kind of piece together a part of the story to show at least how things changed. And it's, to me, it was interesting to do that because it can, and the reason was, it showed how the engineers of theology in the 1990s in the Worldwide Church of God came up with their arguments to wreck the truth in the church, and people were not prepared for those arguments. All right? And they were not new arguments. They were as old as 2,000 years. But because we didn't know our history, we repeated the history. You all know the famous saying about those who fail to learn the lesson of history are doomed to repeat it. One of the key things that you have to understand about the period that we enter into toward the 60s and 70s and 80s AD is a great deal of anti-Jewish sentiment that begins to creep in and impact the church. All right, the church we read about in Acts, to be specific. First of all, you have to understand the Roman Empire, the leadership, the culture of Rome, they did not like Jews, all right? They despised the Jews for a lot of reasons. They were a peculiar people. The Roman Empire had come into Judea about 80 years before the time of Christ and the church and had conquered Judea. They didn't really conquer it. They were invited in. Pompey, the Roman Emperor, General Pompey, came in with his legions. And basically, it was a friendly takeover without a lot of bloodshed. But the Jews didn't like it. But the Jews were a unique people. They had their temple. They didn't have images. They didn't have statues of gods and goddesses. They worshipped one God, the invisible God. The Romans thought that was strange. The Jews took off one day a week. Didn't work. The Sabbath. They thought that the Romans really thought that was odd, all right? Because their cults didn't have anything like that. Right? And if they did, nobody paid any attention to them, kind of like today. What really irked them, I think we covered this earlier, they didn't like the fact that the Jews didn't eat pig, because the Romans just love pig. All right? And they ate pig in every form like we do today. You know, the old saying is that when you kill a pig out on the farm today, you use everything but the oink when it comes to the pig. And they literally, they do. no part. I've never seen it. I've heard about it, the slaughtering of a pig, and it's gross. But everything, even the blood, the brains of pig are used by people who really like pig. My dad used to really like pig. And once a year, he'd go out to the German community near where I grew up in Missouri, because these Germans who today, they love pig too. The old Germans where I grew up, they every fall they would take a day and they'd kill all their pigs and boil it and cut it up and smoke hang the hams in a smokehouse, etc. And they would make something they called blood sausage. Oh no, I'm sorry. They make that too. Head cheese. My dad would buy a loaf of head cheese, and he'd bring it home. And he would open it up on the kitchen table, along with a package of saltine crackers, and he would eat the head cheese. And he would ask me if I would want some head cheese. And this is before the church. Yeah, why not? I'll try it. Head cheese is all the brains that they take out, and they boil it up, and they mix it in with, you know, the gelatin that they get from the everything else in the pig. And then they form it in a loaf and slice it off after it cools down and eat the head cheese. Tastes awful. One bite was about all I had of that. I like pork chops and I like bacon and I liked ham. That was hard for me to give up, but I did give it up. But head cheese was not something I got into. Anyway, I digress. The Romans liked head cheese, and the Jews didn't. So all of this contributed to a great deal of anti-Jewish sentiment. And now comes the church that comes out of Judaism. We're reading about that in Acts. They're keeping the Sabbath. They're keeping the holy days. They don't eat pig. But for a long time, they're able to kind of fly under the radar within the Roman Empire. We'll see that as we continue through the book of Acts. And the Roman Empire doesn't take much notice of this Christian sect. They just think, well, it's another sect of the crazy Jews. And that marches on. But then something happens about 64 AD. Rome burns. You've heard of the Emperor Nero, who fiddled while Rome burned. You ever heard that phrase? Fiddling while Rome burns? Well, the story is he fiddled while Rome burned. Now, that may be fiction. They don't know. They debate that back and forth. But Rome did burn. And he blamed the Christians. Some say that Nero started it for political reasons. Rome was a bunch of ramshackle tenement buildings that had grown up, and it kind of cleared out things, but a lot of people died, and a lot of the city was destroyed. Nero blamed the Christians in 64 AD. This is about the time of where the book of Acts ends. And we would find Paul and Peter and others being persecuted, and Paul winds up being killed in Rome during the mid-60s. Okay? But the Christians get the blame, not the Jews. That's significant. The Christians. We would say that God's church, God's people, the ones we're reading about in the book of Acts, the ones Paul will visit in Rome, the ones he writes the book of Romans to, and they get persecuted. They get killed. They get murdered. But the Jews get off on this one. Okay, so what happens a few years later within the church is they kind of lick their wounds, and the church goes on, but now they've grown larger, they're getting tired of getting beat up, the church. And they begin to take on this anti-Jewish sentiment that's already within the culture. All right, but the church is doing something very Jewish. What are they doing that's very Jewish? Keeping the Sabbath, keeping the Passover, 14th day. That connects them with the Jews. But some within the church begin to think, wait, we don't want to be Jew. We don't want to be connected with them anymore. That's not good. We're not going to get ahead. And they begin to water down and compromise and begin to move away from the things that they have held. This goes on, begins to develop even in the 60s. In some of the historical research, Dr. Bakayoki, the Adventist scholar, has found that some of this some people even beginning to move to a Sunday worship as early as the maybe even the 60s and 70s AD. Heresy begins to come in very quickly within the church and to water down what happens. Another event takes place in 70 AD with the destruction of Jerusalem after about a four-year Jewish war, as they call it. What happens is in Judea. Actually, it starts in Galilee, a Jewish revolt. Jews don't like the Romans. They don't like being under the Romans. They start a revolt in Galilee. It spreads down to Judea. And eventually the Roman legions come in and they surround Jerusalem. There's a siege. Pretty horrible. They cut off food and water. People start eating their own babies in Jerusalem. Josephus discusses this. 70 AD, Jerusalem is destroyed by the Roman legions. And the Second Temple period comes to an end. But there's still Jews are still there. They destroy the temple, but there's still a Jewish population. And about 125, I think is the year, there's another Jewish revolt. It's called the Second Jewish Revolt in history in Jerusalem. This is during the time of the Emperor Hadrian, the Roman Emperor Hadrian. And he puts down that revolt. And at that point, they basically ban all Jews from Jerusalem. They move them out. Those that haven't been killed, they move out. And the only things left are probably the enfeebled, old, who can't go anywhere. And they're going to die anyway, so they just leave them. And they kind of put up a big fence around the side of the temple. The Jews can't even go near it. All right? And the only thing that's left is what we call today the Western Wall. You see the pictures of the Jews at the Western Wall? That's all that's left of the wall around that Second Temple period. Okay, but again, this persecution, and by this time, what is left, and what is the Christian church still around, and it's a mixture of true and false, let's just put it that way, okay? Those that want to abandon anything connected with Judaism are beginning to take over, to just be able to say, hey, we want to get along. And you're into the second and third generation of the church. Think about that, folks. How many of you are second, third, or even fourth generation in your family in the church? Okay? Think about some of the challenges that you have and what we have as, you know, away from what we might call first generation, being those that first came into the church in our families today. We're into the second and third generation of the church here, and there's a different setting and a different feeling. And so what begins to take place is a compromise, false teaching. Christ warned that would happen. The Apostle Paul warns that it would happen, and it does. Not only in Jerusalem, Judea, but throughout wherever the church has gone that we're going to be studying in the book of Acts. There are individuals in the second century, the 100s, AD, that we know from history that are very interesting people. There's a man named Papias. We have fragments of writings of a man named Papias who was writing about the church in the very early first century. They say that maybe this man was a disciple of the Apostle John. Okay? We don't know a whole lot about him. We only have a few fragments of what he wrote. And what we do have is interesting. I won't go into all of that. There's another man named Ignatius. Later in the second century, there's a man named Polycarp, Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, and then another figure called Polycrates. These six individuals form an interesting mixture of what we would call early church fathers, church personalities. I would say that of these, with the writings and what we do know about them, there are some here that if you were to go into their congregation, you might feel comfortable. There's others that you wouldn't feel comfortable with. From what I've read about Papias and his writings, I think I'd feel comfortable sitting in his church. Okay, Ignatius, not so much. Polycarp, thumbs up. Justin Martyr, thumbs down. Okay, he's a Gentile that comes into the church. He's filled with a lot of Greek ideas, and he, as we'll see, he brings in some interesting ideas. Irenaeus, maybe. He is a defender of the faith, but probably not what we would call a credentialed United Church of God minister, okay, that we'd feel comfortable with. Polycrates, yes. I'd give him a thumbs up too. That reflects the setting of the church during this particular time. I won't go into too much more about these individuals. Polycarp is interesting. Polycarp was actually tried. They say that Polycarp was a disciple of John, and it's kind of a link to the apostolic age. He held the ground against Easter, hated heresy, hated heretics. The story about Polycarp is that he was finally, they tried to boil him to death in oil, and he came out of it. That's the story, okay? And then they finally had to kind of beat him to death. But he would not recant. He wouldn't accept heresy and killed by the Romans. Justin Martyr, we know him from about 100 to 167 AD. He was born a pagan, but he joined the Christian church at age 30. There's a lot of his writings that have come down to us. He was an influential writer, and he was martyred. But we would not look upon him as what we would call let's use the term credentialed minister of the Church of God. A number of different doctrines were attacked, and we'll just focus on the Sabbath for a moment since this is where we are. We know from certain writings by Roman authors that their feeling about Jews and the customs of the Jews. Cicero was a famous Roman of the first century. He was a lawyer and a writer. And we have a lot of information about him. His statements about Judaism, not so much the church, but about Judaism, he called anything connected with the Jews a barbaric superstition. Okay? Basically, his view was all those stories of the Old Testament, barbaric superstition. Exodus, Red Sea parting, burning bush, God talking to him from a mountaintop, barbaric superstition. And all the other stories that were connected with the Old Testament. This is how he looked at it. There was a writer named Persius, a satirist. He was probably one of the writers on the Saturday Night Live of the Roman first century world. Okay, his view about the Sabbath was that it enslaves men. Henry, it crimps my style. And I can't get a job. Why? That was his view. But he wrote satire. He was a playwright. And you know, when he commented about things Jewish and specifically about the Sabbath, he looked upon it as, you know, inhibiting. Tacitus is a well-known Roman historian from the first century. And he calls actually I think Tacitus is the second century. He calls the customs of the Jews perverse and disgusting. So these Roman writers kind of give you the flavor of the time. And so if you're a church member and you're keeping things Jewish and beginning to feel the heat socially to where you can't get work, you might get stoned going to church on the Sabbath, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Be tempted to compromise? That's what was going on within the church during this period. And so there was a great divide between the Jews and the Gentile minds, and this conflict spilled over into the church. Eventually the church, the Roman Empire hated anything Jewish. The revolt in Jerusalem, the destruction of Judea. If you go to Rome today, there is an arch still there from that period when the Roman emperor or general Titus went back and had his triumphal march. Because they'd conquered Judea, he built this huge arch. And you can see it today. I've seen it a couple of times. You can Google it and look at it as well. But up on the very top part, on the inside of the arch, there is this scene of the Jewish menorah and the cart and Jews being enslaved, a scene of what took place when the Romans would conquer a people. They drug them back to Rome and they had to kind of go through a big parade right through the forum. And some Jews did that, and they had accoutrements from the temple, kind of like the Babylonians did. So, you know, we've got that's a piece of history right there in Rome today to show a lot of things, but it shows certainly what took place with the Jewish temple. So the Romans kind of dealt a death blow to Judaism and scattered. There was no Jewish state until 1948 in our own time, after 70 AD. There was no sovereign Jewish state in that land. But the church kept going on. They had to find their way. Now they had to make their accommodation within the empire. The story goes along that eventually the church continues to grow. They have this mixture of truth and error coming in, Greek influences coming in, and they begin to move themselves away from keeping the seventh-day Sabbath. And there are certain writers and writings from these individuals. Ignatius, there's a writing called the Epistle of Barnabas, no connection to the Barnabas of the book of Acts. I mentioned Justin Martyr. These people write about the Sabbath. Ignatius, in the first half of the second century, writes, and we have this as part of the record, "If we are still practicing Judaism, we admit we have not received God's favor." Okay? Now, the way you would interpret that, if this is what the man is preaching and writing and putting out in his church newspaper and booklets and magazines that he's distributing to his region within the church, you're hearing that, and you're being taught, well, you don't need to be keeping the Sabbath. You don't need to be keeping the holy days because, well, you haven't received grace. You get a mixture of grace and legalism and law and anti-law in all of this, and it's coated with this anti-Judaism or anti-Semitic feeling, and now the church members and leaders are beginning to teach this. And basically, they're getting a diet in their sermons, or sermonettes. Look, we don't want to be doing Judaism. That's legalistic. That's old covenant. That's the old way. We're Christians. We worship Christ. We have a different view. We look at grace as a grace only and no law, etc. These are some of the arguments that begin, and this one kind of pops up when it comes to Judaism. This epistle to Barnabas, as it is called, we don't know who this Barnabas is exactly, but it introduces within the writings, as they were talking about the day of worship, the idea of the eighth day. Now, the eighth day, if you're counting, what's the seventh day? So if you're talking about commemorating or marking the eighth day, what day would that be? The eighth day is connected out of, there are certain pagan connotations to the eighth day that are semi-sacred, and we see that beginning to creep in. Now, you couple that with the idea of a Sunday morning resurrection of the Savior, as opposed to when? When was Christ resurrected? Saturday? Yeah, was he resurrected on Sunday morning? Okay. But if you begin to keep that as the time of his resurrection, then you begin to adopt that into a time to commemorate him on a day, which connects it into the idea of the eighth day, and we begin to move from Sabbath to Sunday. Okay? These are some of the ideas that began to be commemorated or brought into the church to justify moving from the Sabbath to Sunday. Emily.
At this time, did they have like the writings of the apostles and stuff? Like, did they have the...
Yes, they did. Yeah, they did. I'm one of those proponents that the canon of the New Testament was done by the time of the end of the first century. Yeah. So, but writings continued by other church leaders, and we have those, but they were not then, nor are they today, considered part of the canon of the New Testament. Now, you will find those available. You can find them, you know, I've got them all in books on my shelf at home. You can find them on the internet. Many of those make up what are called the Gnostic writings, Gnostic Gospels in some cases. That's a whole other field of study and discussion, but they did have the writings of the apostles. So this eighth-day concept begins to formulate in there. Justin Martyr, he was a pagan, born a pagan, but he came into the church about age 30, and we have a lot of his writings. He's one of the early church called the early church fathers. He wrote about the Sabbath, and he said, "The new law demands that you observe a perpetual Sabbath." The new law. Okay? What would you think the new law would be referring to? Any ideas? The new covenant. All right? "A new covenant I make with you," Christ said when he changed the symbols on the night of his Passover. This is what he's referring to, this new covenant. He says, it demands we observe a perpetual Sabbath, which is what Charlie was alluding to. This is the idea that actually came into the Worldwide Church of God theology in 1994, 1995, that did trip up a lot of people, caused them the idea was, when Christ was resurrected, all time became holy. There's a perpetual Sabbath. I remember reading it. It was in the church newspaper, or the version then of the United News. And I remember reading it by one of these theologians of the split, and I thought, oh, that's clever. That's clever. So in 1994, when a minister says, look, with the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the new covenant, all time is holy, not just a rigid 24-hour period. And boy, people sucked that up. And that was the last Sabbath they kept. And that night at sundown, they were at Pizza Hut eating pepperoni pizza. And when the next Day of Atonement came along, they had a big cookout at their house with people and served pig. True stories. True stories. It's all done away. And this idea that there's no holy time, every day's a Sabbath, is what people really got tripped up on. And I thought, boy, that's clever. That's good. That's really good. Didn't convince me. But then when I found it from the 2nd century A.D., it confirmed in my mind what I had figured out, that there wasn't, in 1995, it wasn't new truth. It was just old heresy repackaged as new truth. And that's what happened. That's what Satan does. And that was how they got around the Maginot line that I drew on the board here a few days ago, and blew away all the arguments that we had in our Bibles for seven proofs of the Sabbath or everything else. You got to try to stay ahead. You got to try to outthink Satan, which is an impossible thing to do, but Christ has already done that. So later in the 2nd century, there was a major controversy about the Passover, but I'll save this one because I will teach the Passover with you. And we'll get into that next, and we'll come back to this. But the story of what is called the Quarto Decimum controversy over, it's really the controversy of whether those that still wanted to keep the Passover as opposed to those who wanted to start keeping an Easter Sunday. Okay, that was in the 2nd century, well-documented story from that early period of the church. And we'll talk about that. That involves Polycarp and Polycrates. So that, kind of in a nutshell, is a little bit of how these things got changed, or the Sabbath at least got changed, the seventh day to Sunday in the period of the early church. Any questions about that? Okay, from anybody? Okay, all right. So let's come back to the application. The battleground for the end time Christian for all of us is one of lethargy. It's always 3:10 in the afternoon for a Christian today. We can get tired. We can start going asleep. And we have to understand that. With all the attractions in our modern Babylon that are pulling at us, and we have to fight it. And the Sabbath becomes kind of a point that we always need to understand and realize. Not become lax in any part of our life. When it comes to the Sabbath keeping and how we approach the Sabbath, we should keep it. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. We need to know it biblically, theologically. We certainly need to know it spiritually from a relationship with God. We should make a day of honor. God is concerned today about how we observe, how we worship Him, how we keep all points of the law, as that defines our relationship with Him and with our fellow man. I mentioned the other day this last point on the board about establishing a Sabbath ethic. Okay, that I think is critically important to leave you with on this, because you read the Scriptures and you prove, you see where. In the beginning, God rested on the Sabbath day and He created it. Predates Sinai and the covenant made there. In Exodus 16, again, He introduces the Israelites to the Sabbath as if it's already something that's been a part of creation and the whole order of things, which it is. And then it becomes a part of the covenant, and it's a very special part of the covenant with Israel. And then we see Christ keeping the Sabbath. And we see him even expanding understanding about it. We come into our world today, in the modern world, we keep the Sabbath, we understand what the law teaches us, but there's so many things that we have to kind of navigate in order to establish what I call the Sabbath, one's Sabbath ethic. And I encourage you, you establish your own Sabbath ethic, all right? By that I mean, you read the Bible, and you see what it says, and you see the examples, and you see the teaching, you see how Christ kept it, you see how what Paul's teaching is on it. And you have a pretty clear set of guidelines. And it is up to each of us then to honor it, to keep it holy. When you read in Isaiah chapter 58, verses 13 and 14, what God says about the Sabbath there through the prophet Isaiah, that if you keep it, if you remove your foot from the Sabbath, call it a delight, not something burdensome like Ignatius did way back there in the second century, or what some friend that you may have grown up in the church with decided to say about the Sabbath as they were heading out the door of church for the last time. Look, I'm done with that. I've got a career to get to. I want to play sports or this or that. I don't want anything more to do with it. And yet you're still here. How do you keep it? What do the laws about the Sabbath and the instruction about it teach you about how you do it in 2018 on any given week? You know you don't work. What else should you not do or should you do? You figure that out. You figure that out based on your relationship with God, your reading of the Bible, and your ethic, okay? Now, I would encourage you to avoid legalism. All right? Make the Sabbath a delight. It's what God says in Isaiah. Call it a delight. Take your foot off the Sabbath. It would take another sermon to kind of go through all that and explain all of that. But you're pretty intelligent. You can search that out yourself. You should. And you should come to an ethic. Now, I've been keeping the Sabbath since I was 12 years old. All right. For the first few years, I was off and on. I'll be real blunt about it. But once I finally made up my mind, I've been keeping it ever since. I teach it as a minister for years, and I've answered people's questions on it. Frankly, in the field ministry, the Sabbath was my hardest day of the week, driving and speaking twice and this and counseling and all of this. I was worn out. I was ready for Sunday to just recover. But that's what we have to do. God gives a dispensation, I think, for the ministry in that way. But even that, I think, but since coming out of the field ministry and being here, I really do relish the Sabbath because I'm working longer hours and harder in some ways than I ever did. So when it comes to the Sabbath, I crash. But what you do with that time, again, look to the Scriptures to make your judgments. And avoid legalism. You know, sometimes people will say, well, I won't do this, I won't do that. One of the things that comes up is whether or not people will eat out in a restaurant on the Sabbath, okay? We've had that kind of swirl around in past classes here at ABC. We have some in the ministry that feel that you should not eat out on the Sabbath, okay, in a restaurant. While others of us, and I include myself in that group, have no problem with it, okay? Now, I'm not going out every week, and I'm not to, is it a sin to eat out on the Sabbath? I don't think so, in a restaurant. Am I hiring a servant? I don't think so. I study the Scriptures, and that waiter or waitress is not my servant in the biblical sense. Sorry, don't go there with me, okay? What the Bible talks about when it comes to the servant is somebody you own. All right, God says you give them the Sabbath off, and you do. If you're an employer, shut your place down, which are church members that have businesses, they do shut it down on the Sabbath. I don't buy the idea that, you know, you're hiring or you're causing someone to serve you is violating the teaching in Exodus. We have a paper on it, and the very fact that we have a paper on it in the church about Sabbath observance that was very early on created was to keep that particular issue about Sabbath keeping from becoming a point of division within the church. So If you choose to not eat out on the Sabbath, that's your business, because you create your Sabbath ethic. I have no problem with that. You make up your own mind. But don't try to teach that to your congregation. Don't try to enforce that in any other setting within the United Church of God. That's our policy and that's our practice, and we encourage, teach our ministers in that way. All right. If you choose not to, and you keep it to yourself, I think God can honor that. Just don't try to encroach on someone else's liberty, as they have the same liberty to establish an ethic in their own personal life before God. Any questions about that? We've got a minute. Emily wants to ask a question. Go ahead.
Have you ever had to go to somebody who did own a company and tell them, like, hey, shut it down or anything like
that? No, I've not had to tell them that. I've had members who, many members through the years that have had Sabbath conflicts, and we've worked through those. I had a dairy farmer one time, and we had back in those days, we had a kind of a loose thing with dairy farmers. To be honest, we should have had a board. They eventually quit keeping the Sabbath and left the church, too. You got to milk those cows twice a day, and you know, one or two cows is one thing. 500 cows is another thing. So, you know, we've got those situations. You know, it's best, you know, if you've got an ox in the ditch, you go out and you get that cow out of the ditch, okay? Farmers have to, you know, and should do, you know, there are certain things you will have to do to keep things going, but reduce it as much as you can. Others with industries, I know John Miller up here in Ohio has a big industry. He shuts it down at 3 o'clock every day, winter, summer, shut down at 3 o'clock. And then manufacturing restarts 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. That was the way he was doing it. And that way, so whether it's December or July, his place is shut down on the Sabbath. And he's had a strict rule on that. I always thought that was a good way to handle it. So, any other questions? Work your own Sabbath ethic out. And just look at the Scripture, pray about it, and you know the broad building blocks are non-negotiable. But be careful not to get off into legalism, and what you set for yourself, that's between you and God. I think the church could go along just fine on that basis. Okay, we're done with the Sabbath.